On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman is convicted of fatally shooting her 4-year-old twin sons.
There is no justice. There's nothing that's going to bring my little boys back.
And I asked her what happened, and she said, I shot my kids.
Then Dina Fairchild tells her story. She allegedly set a fire that killed her boyfriend and his parents.
I could hear him screaming. I mean, it was almost an inhuman sound.
No, I would not have set the fire. I would have done my best to stop it.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Leslie Demenick and Dina Fairchild. On March 17, 2001, Antonio Ortiz made a gruesome discovery when he visited his girlfriend, Leslie Demenick, at her father's home in Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida.
911, what is your emergency?
Oh my God, help me! Oh my God!
Ortiz told the operator that Leslie's 4-year-old twin boys, Jamie and Johnny Demenick, were shot in the head.
There was a lot of blood on the floor and on the bed. It was more of an execution-style murder.
When authorities arrived at the scene, they found the young boy's mother, Leslie Demenick, unconscious on the bed next to her fatally wounded children with a .357 Magnum beside her.
The evidence showed that the children did not fit into her lifestyle.
Police charged 31-year-old Leslie Demenick with murdering her young sons.
Leslie was chemically, clinically depressed.
She said, I don't know why I did it.
Was Leslie Demenick temporarily insane, or was this a cold-blooded murder to get rid of her children? In 1969, Leslie Demenick, the eldest of three daughters, was born in Charlottesville, Virginia, to John and Catherine Ewing.
We moved to Maryland shortly after I was born, and I grew up in Maryland.
We had a pretty normal family relationship. Leslie was always very intelligent. Even in the first grade.
Very kind to others, loved animals. She was, was into brownies and Girl Scouts and lived a very normal, child's life, I think.
She was raised in a very nurturing environment. Her mother and father were very caring. She was a very bright young lady. Her IQ was about 117.
When she was 12 years old, Leslie's parents got divorced. While she continued to have a good relationship with her mom and sisters, Leslie ended up living with her dad because she was enrolled in a school close to his home. Like many teens during their high school years, Leslie experimented with recreational drugs.
Started smoking marijuana, and that sort of grew into LSD, and we used that off and on, and experimented with cocaine, I think, once or twice.
She was very popular. She liked to party, yes, she did. And so we had to keep an eye on her, but we kept an eye on all three girls, so yes.
After graduating high school, Leslie studied art and French in Belgium for 6 months.
I had good teachers. It was a good experience. But when I moved back to the United States, I decided that art was really not where I was headed.
According to court records, Leslie told a psychiatrist that when she returned to the United States, she attended Loyola College in Baltimore, Maryland, but she dropped out after a year. Those records also say Leslie admitted to having several relationships with men while continuing to abuse alcohol and drugs.
She made some bad choices. Instead of pursuing a very good career that she had an opportunity to pursue, she chose to engage in drugs and alcohol abuse.
At age 25, Leslie moved from Maryland to the wealthy area of Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida, where both her mom and dad had relocated. In March of 1996, Leslie met a 22-year-old naval officer named Tommy Demenick while she and friends were playing pool at a local bar.
He seemed like a good person, and manners, so, I was interested in him.
The couple dated for a few months before he was deployed.
He had to go away for a 6-month
cruise in the Persian Gulf. And I thought that I might be pregnant, so I told him before he left, well, I think I might be pregnant.
Leslie confirmed the news and called Tommy while he was in the Gulf.
He was happy about it. I was happy about it.
In December 1996, when Tommy returned home, they got married.
We didn't have a wedding. We just went to the courthouse.
2 months later, Leslie gave birth to twin boys, Johnny and Jamie.
It was wonderful. They were beautiful and healthy.
She was the perfect mother. Everybody in the family was impressed at what a good mother she was.
Her whole life revolved around taking good care of these little boys.
In addition to caring for the boys, Leslie took online classes at a Florida community college, where she was awarded Student of the Year in 1998 for her straight A average. But while she succeeded as a mother and a student, her marriage was failing. Leslie says she was left alone for months at a time to raise the twins while Tommy was at sea with his job in the Navy.
He tried his best, and he was a good father, and he did everything he knew how to try to make things right. When he came back, everybody had to readjust. He had a hard time adjusting to the boys, and he had a hard time adjusting to it as a family unit.
According to Leslie, the couple fought often, and she says, Tommy's long absences put an additional strain on their relationship.
I had said to him several times, you know, I need you to be here. I need to communicate with you, and, you know, you're not communicating with me, and please, let's do something about this.
In December 1999, while Tommy was away at sea, Leslie sent him an email saying she wanted a divorce. 9 months later, she met Antonio Ortiz, a local sports photographer.
We immediately started a relationship as soon as we met. We fell in love, and we were together every day since the day we met, pretty much.
He was always very affectionate, and he loved the boys. The boys loved him, and it was a good relationship.
But as Leslie's divorce was about to become final, she says she became depressed.
Tommy and Leslie were very civil with each other. Everything was great. He just wanted the boys as well.
I'm having trouble sleeping, feeling depressed and anxious. And I said, let me go see my primary care physician.
Leslie said a nurse practitioner at a local health clinic gave her trial samples of the antidepressant Zoloft and the anti-anxiety drug Xanax.
My lips were swollen and my face was kind of swollen up, and I started noticing that I had hives.
Leslie claims that when she called her doctor's office, the nurse practitioner told her to continue taking the drugs. After 2 weeks, she began to hallucinate, lose her memory, and began drinking heavily.
I found her one afternoon just laid out in her bed, and her eyes were rolling back, and it looked like she was having a seizure. That's when she told me that she had first pulled out the gun and was thinking of killing herself.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
She just shot her two kids.
Who just shot?
Her mom, the mom! Damn it, get over here!
In March 2001, 31-year-old Leslie Demenick was taking medication for depression and undergoing a difficult divorce from her husband, Tommy. At the heart of the breakup was a custody battle over their 4-year-old twin sons, Jamie and Johnny. For financial and emotional support, Leslie had moved in with her father and future stepmother in their townhouse in Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida.
I saw her as the most loving mother I had experienced with twin boys, patient and creative.
At the time Leslie moved into the townhouse with her dad, she had a gun her father gave her for protection.
When I moved in with my father, I had given him the gun. So we put it in the closet, you know, tucked it away up on the top shelf, you know. We were concerned about, you know, the boy's safety.
Leslie's divorce was settled on March 13th, 2001. She was awarded custody of the twins. Her husband, Tommy, was allowed visitation. But despite the favorable divorce outcome, Leslie says she was still depressed and suffering debilitating side effects from her antidepressant, including hallucinations, memory loss, and increased alcohol use.
Before I started the Zoloft, I was just a very on and off drinker, you know, a couple of beers on the weekend with everybody. When I started taking the Zoloft, I had this like basically uncontrollable urge to drink.
Leslie says she also began to have thoughts about killing herself. One afternoon, the first week of March 2001, she nearly acted on it.
I had gone into the closet and got the gun. I was going to shoot myself. And I was standing in the closet holding the gun when I realized what I was going to do.
It was after this event that Leslie confided her suicidal tendencies to Antonio.
I told her, okay, we're having some problems here. This medication is obviously having a negative effect on you, and you know, you have to go to the doctor.
According to court documents, the following day, Leslie says when she called her doctor, she found out he was booked for 3 weeks, so she saw the nurse practitioner that originally gave her the Zoloft. She claims he immediately switched her medication to another antidepressant, Paxil.
I said, well, you know, aren't you supposed to wean off of them, wean off and then wean on or something? And he said, no, just stop taking the Zoloft and start taking the Paxil.
And she also told them that she had suicidal thoughts. And I think that somebody should have asked what they could do to help her. You just can't let a patient walk out with two young children. And you just can't do that.
But court documents state that the nurse practitioner said Leslie did not mention any suicidal thoughts to him. For 3 days, Leslie took Paxil and the anti-anxiety medication Xanax, combined with alcohol. On the night of March 16, 2001, she and her boyfriend Antonio got into an argument when he asked her if she was sure she was taking the correct dosage of her medication.
And she hit me. She just, like, whacked me right across the face, and it was just like, whoa. I started noticing she was getting physical. I was like, whoa, this is totally out of character.
According to court records, in the afternoon of March 17, 2001, Jamie and Johnny Demenick were watching cartoons in their mother's bedroom. Earlier in the day, Leslie had called Antonio to set up a date that night to talk. About 3:48 p.m., she called her ex-husband, Tommy, and asked if he could babysit the twins. But he said he was busy. At 4:02, she called Antonio to say Tommy couldn't watch the boys. When she hung up, she did the unthinkable.
She left the room, walked through her father's bedroom into a closet, and high on a shelf in the closet was an unloaded revolver. It was a .357 Magnum. Took ammunition and loaded all of the cylinder holes. So it had 6 shots in it. She walked out of the closet, back into the children's room. The children are still watching Scooby-Doo. She then walked up to the first one, James. She put the gun against his forehead. She did pull the trigger, and his skull exploded. The second child went into a panic, and that little boy tried to run away, and she shot at him one time, missed him. He's on his way out the door. She shoots him and grazes his skull. Then she pins him down and puts the gun to the side of his head and kills him.
She called me and just immediately said, I just shot the boys in the head. Like, what did you say? I kind of lost touch with her. I guess she had passed out by then.
Antonio immediately drove to Leslie's father's home, where she had been living with her sons.
I pull up into the house, and as soon as I open the door, I smell gunpowder. And I immediately knew. Leslie was laying on the bed. The gun was beside her. One of the boys was on the bed. The other one was on the floor. And I can tell both of them weren't moving. And I immediately called 911.
She just shot her 2 kids.
Who just shot?
Her mom, the mom! Damn it, get over here! I'm not sleeping with you now! Oh my God, oh my God! She killed him, she killed him.
When I first arrived, I seen Anthony Ortiz standing out in front of the residence. He's screaming, they've been shot. They're upstairs, they've been shot.
Detective Burris ran upstairs to the bedroom where Leslie was with her deceased twin sons.
She was lying in bed next to James. She had the covers over the top half of her body pulled up to about to where her neck was. She wasn't saying anything. Her eyes were closed. I did notice a large amount of blood covering her face. Wasn't crying or nothing. I asked her, "Ma'am, can you hear me?" At that time, Ms. Demenick opened her eyes, looked around the room and looked at me, and I asked her, "What happened?" And she said, "I shot my kids."
I don't remember any of that day. I can tell you the bits and pieces that I do remember, but there's not a lot that I remember. I don't remember the day before, and I don't remember the day before that.
When they said the boys had been shot by their mother, it was a nightmare.
When I first came on the scene, I found out what happened. I knew right then, I knew why it happened. It could not have happened if it hadn't been for something else. And we know what that was. It was the antidepressants, the Paxil and the Zoloft.
Leslie was taken by ambulance to a nearby hospital, accompanied by two police detectives. During the trip, they recorded their conversation with Leslie, who was in shock over what she had done.
What do you think's wrong with you?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I'm going to kill my children.
At the hospital, Sergeant Jay Lawing interviewed Leslie.
We were taking samples of the blood off of her face, and she started crying and kind of said, "Oh my God, I've killed my babies." She never could give me a reason why.
Leslie confessed several times to killing her children, but told investigators that she didn't have control over her actions and really wanted to kill herself instead.
I'd seen a drop of blood or something on my leg, or a bone fragment or something. It was at that point that I realized that what had happened was real.
Once we got the blood test back, we knew that she was under the influence of alcohol. And then once I started talking to her, she told me she had taken some Xanax and some Paxil, so we knew that was in her system.
Her blood level at the time it was tested was 324, 0.324. That's four times the driving while drunk level of blood.
Investigators confiscated 11 empty beer cans, an empty bottle of bourbon, Paxil, Zoloft, and Xanax from the crime scene. That night, Leslie was charged with two counts of murder and taken to the local jail. When Women Behind Bars continues.
It's difficult to convince a jury that in one's entire lifetime, they've only been temporarily insane for 3 minutes. And those happen to be the 3 minutes that they committed the homicide.
And later in this episode of Women Behind Bars, Dina Fairchild is accused of arson and the murder of three.
I caught fire while I was standing at the back door. The whole side of my head was on fire. The front of my legs were on fire.
The night of March 17, 2001, 31-year-old Leslie Demenick was booked in the St. Johns County Jail in St. Augustine, Florida. She was charged with shooting to death her 4-year-old twin boys.
Shortly after I was in the jail, a couple weeks, a month maybe, I had a dream. Me and the boys were walking down the street, and they went running ahead of me. And they turned into stars.
In the nearly 5 years Leslie was in jail while awaiting trial, she met with Dr. Ernest Miller, a psychiatrist for the defense. After 70 hours of evaluation, he concluded that she was insane at the time of the murders and that she believed she was taking her children to a better place.
She saw the world as a hell in which they were living. And she, in her distorted mind and thinking, projected onto the children that they were having the same problems.
It's not logical to argue that she was trying to send the children to a better place, when in fact she felt that she was going to burn in hell for the evil thing that she had done to the children.
On January 3rd, 2006, Leslie Demenick went to trial. Her lawyers argued that she had killed her children in a moment of insanity caused by drinking alcohol while taking a combination of antidepressants and Xanax.
Laypersons believe that a mother who kills her two 4-year-old sons this way has to be crazy. But that's a different standard than the legal standard of insanity.
The prosecution argued that Florida's standard for insanity requires that a person must not know what they are doing or not know that it is wrong. To support his theory that Leslie knew what she was doing, the prosecution showed the jury a timeline of phone calls Leslie made before and after the murders.
All the things she did, the things she said, were all very normal. We know that at 4:16 that afternoon, after she had killed them, she picked up her telephone call and she dialed Antonio. And she said, "Antonio, I've killed the children." She knew what she was doing and had done.
But Dr. Miller believes that Leslie's calls before and after the murders were not relevant to the question of whether or not she was sane at the time of the killings.
People do it all the time. They drink, they become intoxicated on drugs and or alcohol, street drugs or alcohol. And they have periods of lucidity, they have periods of detachment from reality.
Sergeant Jay Lawing, who interviewed Leslie after the crime, said the motive was anger.
She killed him because she was upset.
Upset, Lawing says, because Leslie could not go out with her boyfriend the night of the murders, because she said her ex-husband Tommy could not take care of the twins.
I loved my children more than anything. That despite what is being said about me doing this to get back at my husband, that's not true.
The prosecution argued that Leslie killed her boys to be free, to return to her single lifestyle.
She wanted to return to her pre-marriage lifestyle of drugs and multiple male friends. And she couldn't fit the children into that.
That's total nonsense. They were clutching at straws. They were looking for any way they could find to malign her character.
At the heart of the trial was the international debate about the possible dangers of antidepressants, also known as SSRIs. Dr. Barbara Kerwin, a psychologist for the prosecution, testified that after evaluating Leslie, she found her to be a woman in control who was sane when she committed the murders.
Barbara Kerwin said basically that she was self-absorbed, narcissistic, and that SSRIs have nothing to do with making people homicidal, or suicidal for that matter.
The most emotional testimony came from the victim's father, Tommy Demenick.
He just told a straightforward story about what his children meant to him. And everybody in the courthouse teared up for that one.
I think it was a stream of consciousness that pervaded throughout the trial, that Leslie Demenick knew what she was doing. That night, she was in charge, and she knew what she was doing, and she knew that it was wrong. And I think that all of the witnesses provided some evidence of that. Each one provided a piece in this puzzle that painted the picture of Leslie Demenick and what she did. Difficult to convince a jury that in one's entire lifetime they've only been temporarily insane for 3 minutes, and those happened to be the 3 minutes that they committed the homicide.
I think the verdict was a foregone conclusion, and the only real sentence variable was whether she would get consecutive or concurrent, and Judge Alexander gave her consecutive just to ensure that she would not get out of prison.
She was a victim of the pharmaceutical companies and the legal system.
Not a time goes by that if I close my eyes, I can see him here.
There is no justice. There's nothing that's going to bring my little boys back.
Leslie Demenick is now serving two consecutive life sentences at a maximum security prison in Florida. She is currently not taking any medication or receiving therapy.
I can't just think about my children. You know how beautiful they were. And sweet and loving. You know, I have to I can't think of them just in... just in the way a mother thinks of their children. Because when I think of them, I always think that they're dead, and that they're dead because of me.
Next up on this episode of Women Behind Bars, a woman is blamed for arson and the murder of three.
I started dozing off, and the next thing I know, the house blew up.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to www.wetv.com. July 21st, 1996. Joe Martin and his elderly parents, Joe Sr. and Tommy Grace Martin, died in a fire that swept through their small home.
I've had numerous arson investigations, and this one with the elderly couple inside is certainly right up there with the worst of them.
A fire investigator suspected 41-year-old Dina Fairchild after he saw blisters on her hands and legs.
It would indicate that a liquid accelerant had splashed onto her and had caught on fire at some point.
She wasn't well. Mentally, she was, becoming unhooked, unstable.
Did Dina Fairchild intentionally commit a triple homicide, or was she an innocent victim in the ordeal? Dina Fairchild was one of four girls. She was born at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas in 1955, where her father worked as a mechanic.
My dad was a really good-looking guy, and a lot of women liked my dad, and my dad liked women.
When her father left the Air Force, he moved the family to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and became a truck driver. He was on the road a lot while Dina's mom watched the kids.
I worshiped my daddy. When my daddy was gone on the truck, my mama used to let me sleep on the couch to watch for him, okay?
A memory from Dina's childhood which foreshadows the future comes from Dina's sister, Marcia, who claims that when Dina was 7 years old, she set her mother's housecoat in flames. And Dina's father, Charles, said that when Dina was a child, she torched their curtains.
There were other comments made indicating that she was fixated by fire.
But Dina denies any memory of these incidents involving fire from her childhood. When she was 10, her world was shattered when her parents divorced and Dina went to live with her mother.
My mama had a real bad nervous breakdown when she broke up with my father. She was never the same after that.
2 years after the divorce, her mother, Olivia, remarried. Her second husband had four other children.
We all got along really great. It was me and my stepfather that didn't get along.
Dina says her stepfather never made her feel like she belonged in his family.
I took a lot of beatings off that man.
Whether or not she was actually abused, Dina was so desperate to get away from her family that at age 13, she ran away from home to live with relatives in Milwaukee. When that didn't work out, at age 14, she began living on the streets and hanging out with the wrong crowd.
I was trying to be this hard, tough person that could handle anything, deal with anything, and I was trying to make it on my own, but I ran with some friends and some bad things had happened to me.
Dina claims she was raped by two men at two different times, but she did not report them. During one of those rapes, she says she became pregnant. Soon after, she was picked up with friends by police who were patrolling the streets of Milwaukee for runaways. From the backseat of the cop car, Dina attacked one of the police officers, a foolish act that would change the course of her life.
I pulled a knife on him, and I put it around his throat, and I said, "Okay, sweetheart, pull over, we're getting out here," I thought I was being really cute. When he tried to take the knife from me, we both got cut. And that was why I went to the reform school.
Dina gave birth to a daughter while in custody, but gave her up for adoption. After 3 years in reform school, Dina then moved to Florida, and during her 20s and 30s, she had several boyfriends and three more children out of wedlock.
I don't talk about my children because I gave them up. And I don't like to bring them into anything. I don't believe in abortion.
Dina did raise one of those children on her own, a son she named Matthew, born in 1986.
I loved him to death. People used to tease me about him being connected to me at the hip.
Matthew was the apple of his mother's eye. She was proud of his high IQ.
It was in the gifted range, so it was around 130. He was just very smart.
Even as a young child, he was in tune with his mother's struggles.
She felt worthless. She felt useless. She seemed to insinuate that life wasn't worth living and seemed to have some very suicidal tendencies.
But Matthew says that while he loved his mother as a child, he remembers her unpredictable rage.
When she was drinking, she'd have bursts of anger and she'd blame everyone else. And then she would have sudden, oftentimes violent mood swings where she would turn and go in introspective and blame everything on herself.
Matthew remembers he and his mother moving around Florida a lot until he was 9. To pay the bills, Dina worked low-paying jobs as a cashier.
My mother often worked long, long shifts or would work multiple jobs, and therefore I was home alone or at a babysitter's a lot of the time.
Dina dated several men throughout Matthew's childhood.
I get along good with truck drivers and construction workers. They're my box of chocolates, okay?
One of those truck drivers was Joe Martin, whom she met while she was a cashier at a truck stop in St. Augustine.
He would come in and he would stand at the end of the counter and talk to me, and his CB handle was running late because he was always late. And I used to tease him about the reason he was late was because he stood around and flirted with girls all the time at the truck stop.
I remember meeting him and, liking him at least to some level. He certainly seemed better than people my mother had dealt with in the past.
We started dating, and him and my son hit it off right off the bat.
Joe lived with his mother, Tommy Grace, and his father, Joe Martin Sr., on a small farm in St. Augustine.
They had animals. They had chickens and cows and pigs and ducks and dogs and everything.
Dina said her son would visit the farm on the weekends while she worked.
For my son, it was like a gift from heaven. He had a man, and he had a grandparent.
Walter and Marilyn Schweinfurths knew the elder Martins for more than 20 years.
They were real nice people, and they liked to party in the Moose Lodge, and we got along real good.
But the Martins' peaceful life was about to change as their son's relationship with Dina Fairchild heated up.
Joe and I got married in 94, and I wanted to marry him on July 4th because he was fireworks, okay?
But the marriage was never made official.
There were never any documents filed with the court. No marriage certificate was ever filed.
Dina and her son moved in with Joe and his parents. There was friction between the two mothers, Dina and Tommy, right from the start.
Tommy wouldn't let her in the house. Tommy hated her.
My mother and his mother would have disagreements, and because of that, Joe's relationship became strained between his parents and my mother.
They did both have tempers. There was numerous altercations between the two, usually involved some type of alcohol.
Apparently he and Dina drank quite a bit and fought a lot.
Police say the couple fought so loudly, officers were often called to investigate.
The neighbors had called the sheriff's office on numerous occasions, and we responded out here and dealt with the issues.
In July of 1994, police filed a report of domestic violence, but neither Dina nor Joe pressed charges against each other.
I know little Joe had been trying to get rid of her, get her to leave.
She wouldn't go home.
There were times where she seemed to depend on him, and there were times where she hated him.
Police say that on July 21st, 1996, Joe and Dina were drinking all day. They had gone with Matthew to run an errand to buy hay for Joe's farm animals.
We'd gone that day and picked up some hay. And I remember we started to unload it and we decided to stop for a while we ate dinner.
That evening, 9-year-old Matthew was watching TV in the barn behind the house where he slept. He says his mother and Joe had been drinking when they had a violent argument. She left the house and stayed with her son in the barn. While Joe and his parents were sleeping, Matthew and Dina watched the movie She-Devil, starring Roseanne Barr.
The premise of the movie was that she was tired of her old life and that she had gotten sick and fed up with everything, so she decided to torch her house and move on and have a new life.
I started dozing off, and that was what was on TV when I fell asleep. And the next thing I know, the house blew up. I heard the explosion, and I ran for the house.
Matthew says what he remembers most about the fire is Joe Martin Jr.'s screams inside the house.
I remember we went back out towards the barn, and I could hear him screaming. It seemed to carry on forever. I mean, it was almost an inhuman sound.
So when I got to the neighbors, I told her our house was on fire, and I told her to call 911.
911, house on fire, quickly! Right next door to me. Calm down. Okay, I'll get the fire department on the way. Three other people there, too. The woman just come over here screaming.
By the time firefighters arrived at the scene, the blaze fully engulfed the house.
As I entered the front of the house, I observed three bodies, and it was determined at the end of my investigation that this was an incendiary fire, an intentionally set fire using an accelerant.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
The back of my hand got burned real bad. The whole side of my head was on fire.
In July 1996, the Florida State Fire Marshal's office determined the fatal house fire that took three lives was the act of an arsonist. Dina Fairchild's boyfriend, Joe Martin Jr., and his elderly parents died in the blaze. Dina and her 9-year-old son, Matthew, lived with them, but each said they were in the barn when the blaze broke out. Sergeant Robert Gober worked on the investigation.
Based on where the bodies were recovered, I did a crime scene sketch of the residents, including measurements from where their bedrooms were to where their bodies were found, and where the front entry was.
The sketch determined the three Martins were just a few feet from escaping the fire out the front door before they collapsed.
The autopsy showed that all three victims died from smoke inhalation.
Investigators discovered the fire was started by gasoline.
There was a definite pattern on the floor where the accelerant had been poured. I had talked with Dina Fairchild at some point during the investigation. There were some unusual markings on her hands and legs that appeared to be blistering. At this time, I'm beginning to think that there may have been some more involvement than she's indicating.
Oh, I caught fire while I was standing at the back door. I had my hand up in front of my face. The back of my hand got burned real bad. The whole side of my head was on fire. The front of my legs were on fire.
But investigators were suspicious of Dina's explanation.
It actually appeared that she had splashed an accelerant onto herself, which at some point in time did actually catch on fire.
They became more skeptical when a police detective interviewed her 9-year-old son, Matthew.
He had been coached by his mother to come up with a story, and he followed that in the beginning, and then I believe he broke down.
What did Mommy tell you about going to jail?
She said, she told me not to tell anyone.
Anyone what?
What happened, because she go to jail for a long time.
Is she talking about what happened with the fire?
Yes.
Okay.
He was matter-of-fact about the things that he heard. And some of the things that he heard, I'm sure, will stick with him for the rest of his life.
Both Joe and his parents were sleeping. It was late at night. She, at some point, decided to take a can of gasoline that we kept for lawnmowers and started pouring it through and around the house. She soaked a pile of laundry that was close to Joe's bedroom, presumably to target him specifically. And she couldn't get it lit, so she asked me to help her. So I went and I got a bit of hay, and she couldn't light that either.
Okay, and what happened with the fire?
Well, she sent me out to the carport, and she told me to go get a twig.
Okay.
And I went over to a bale of hay, and I found it twig. And she told me to put gasoline on it from the tank.
The 9-year-old even drew a picture of the kerosene can he used to soak the twig in.
She used the kerosene and soaking it with the hay, she was able to get it lit and was able to get the house lit. From there, I mean, the place, you know, almost instantly turned into an inferno.
I don't like my son being called a liar, but yeah, that if it's straight out, yeah, it was lying. No, I would not have set the fire. I would have done my best to stop it.
If you're going to try to look at logic when it comes to criminals, you know, you'll never find it.
Dina Fairchild was charged with arson and 3 counts of murder. Her son was not charged for his part in the fire. He was sent to live with his cousins in Idaho. Prosecutor Robin Strickler said Dina's motive was simple.
She was angry. She and Joe Martin had had a fight that night. She didn't get along with Joe Martin's mother. So to me, it was really a matter of just anger.
A year later, after the fire, Matthew Fairchild returned to St. Augustine for his mother's trial. The prosecution was seeking the death penalty, and Matthew was their star witness.
He didn't look at her when he testified. And the only time that he did, I think, was when they asked him if she was in the courtroom, and he pointed to her.
The 10-year-old boy reiterated the same story he told investigators when he was interviewed, including how his mother used a pink lighter to ignite the flames.
I knew very well that what I was saying was probably going to be one of the keystones to put my mother in prison or, you know, even possibly give her the death sentence.
It was crucial testimony. I just remember him being an exceptional witness and very good on the stand as a little kid.
After the testimony from fewer than a dozen witnesses, the prosecution rested its case and the trial was in recess.
So we had a break, we came back up. The defense attorney came to me and said that she's gonna take the stand and say that Matthew is the one who committed the crime.
All she said was that her son had tried to do this. She didn't offer an explanation as to why he would do it.
I couldn't believe that I had actually took the stand and said that, but I was so scared that I was gonna go to the chair.
I remember reading an article in the St. Augustine Record after the trial was over that the jury had given mercy. Not mercy for Miss Fairchild, but mercy for Matthew, so that he didn't have to spend the rest of his life knowing that he put his mother in the electric chair.
Dina Fairchild is now 53. She's serving time at a correctional institute in South Florida. Her son Matthew lived with relatives in Idaho until he was 15, and then returned to Florida to live in 2 different group homes. He now lives on his own. This year, the 21-year-old hopes to get his degree in computer technology.
I don't drink, I don't do drugs. I've pretty much, you know, learned from my mother's mistakes.
Matthew says he only learned years after the trial that his mother blamed him for the fire in court.
I felt betrayed. At that point, I began to hate her.
He no longer keeps in contact with his mother and still lives with haunting questions he would like her to answer someday.
Why did you claim that I was responsible for what you did? What drove you to that point? And was there ever a point where you thought to yourself, maybe I should get some sort of help?
Dina Fairchild says she still loves her son. She has not seen him since the trial 12 years ago. She still maintains her innocence and has hope she might someday be freed.
I've read stories where women got cleared and got out. It could happen while I'm still alive. You can turn things around, you know? You can have a life.